Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's been about, what, 5 years since the subprime mortgage crisis blew up the economy? Well, now there's word the White House is pushing for more home loans for riskier borrowers. Here we go again, or is it different this time? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, April 3rd. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us. There have been signs for months now that the housing market is making a comeback. But the White House is worried that too many people still can't buy homes because of their lackluster credit. And the Washington Post reported today the administration is nudging banks to loosen their lending standards and start making loans to a wider range of borrowers. Reporter Shannon Mullen asks, is it too soon?
The president's basically promising not to punish banks that start lending again to people with weaker credit. If those homeowners later default, the Federal Housing Administration insures the loans. And the FHA wants banks to size up potential borrowers more subjectively by looking at factors like savings.
Somehow making it a procedure to use more intuitive judgment about the borrower, probably a good idea if it's done right.
Economist and Yale professor Robert Shiller compares banks that are holding out for borrowers with stellar credit to colleges that look only at applicants' SAT scores.
Right now, lower-income borrowers are just shut out of the market. That is a problem.
Critics of the plan say lenders should still be applying lessons learned from the housing crisis, requiring larger down payments and shorter loan terms. Ed Pinto is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a former Fannie Mae executive.
FHA's lending standards still remain way too risky for many working class families, and this push would just make people who should be given an opportunity to achieve the American dream give them a nightmare instead.
But the head of the Mortgage Bankers Association, David Stevens, says lenders are starting to allow for the fact that they may have overcorrected.
The devil is in the details, and only by seeing the actual real policy proposals will we know what this ultimately may do to help the credit markets expand.
So what are those details? The FHA declined to comment. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
The Securities and Exchange Commission caught up to the 21st century today. The agency issued a ruling basically saying, okay, guys, you were right. Posting corporate news on Twitter or Facebook is just as legit as a media release or a regulatory filing. The SEC even said it encouraged companies to seek out new forms of communication to better connect with shareholders. Memo to the SEC, Facebook's about a decade old, but anyway, the whole brouhaha over tweeting and Facebooking corporate news started last summer with a Facebook post by Netflix CEO Reed Hastings. Joseph Grunfest is a former SEC commissioner who teaches business and law at Stanford. Professor Grunfest, welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
So remind us exactly what the CEO of Netflix posted on his Facebook page that caused such a ruckus in the first place.
He posted information indicating that the company had crossed 1 billion hours of viewing per month. And it was kind of surprising to me that the SEC got so uncomfortable about that, because the company's own general counsel had testified before Congress just 2 weeks before that the company was almost at a billion hours per month.
Yeah. But what was the SEC's argument?
Well, the SEC's argument is that this information about a billion hours per month was material, non-public information, and it should have been disclosed through different means to the market as a whole. It shouldn't have appeared on Reed Hastings' personal Facebook page without prior notification to the market that that's where people should go in order to find this sort of information.
So the SEC is now saying this is okay. Twitter, Facebook, they're legitimate channels for distributing investor news. Do you think companies are going to start issuing everything through social media first now?
No, I think it'll only be for special situations where companies will tend to use social media. The typical disclosures by publicly traded companies, for example, their forms 10-K and their 10-Qs, the very large forms, will continue to be disclosed regular way. You can't post that on Facebook, and you certainly can't tweet all that information out and get it into the marketplace.
Do you think companies could take advantage of this in any way? Could they use this ruling to their advantage in some way on social media?
Sure. You know, if you've got a large consumer base or an investor base that's heavily invested in Facebook as a communications channel or that tweets a lot, why wouldn't you communicate with your user base the same way that they communicate with themselves?
Yeah. But here's a question. At what point can you still call it social media if these sites are basically, you know, another distribution channel for corporate news? Are we taking the social out of social media and it's becoming corporate media?
There is a sense in which Facebook and Twitter are becoming new forms of doing corporate press releases. But even if that's true, what's the matter with that? These are channels that began as social media. They're now social media and more. And I think that just speaks to the great success of the medium.
I thought it was a little funny in its statement today, the SEC, in referring to Facebook and Twitter, somehow they called it new information channels. We encourage the use of new information channels. How many folks at the SEC are on Facebook and Twitter actively, do you think?
Well, you know, my guess is that the number of people at the SEC actively on Facebook and Twitter is probably smaller than the number of people at Facebook and Twitter who are on Facebook and Twitter.
And what about the people running these big public companies, like the CEOs and the senior execs and the directors? Are those people, you know, tweeting every 24 hours a day, or what do you think?
Well, you know, different companies have very different social media profiles. You know, for example, Goldman Sachs tweeted to the SEC the other day, thanks for allowing the use of social media to disclose this information.
Joseph Grunfest at Stanford's Rock Center for Corporate Governance. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That Facebook post by Netflix CEO Reed Hastings wasn't the first controversial corporate tweet. We've put together a slideshow of some pretty big blunders. You can cast your vote for the worst. Just go to marketplace.org. Jitters over North Korea plus weak job numbers equaled a down stock market today. Details when we do the numbers. So let's do something now that we don't normally do here on Marketplace. We're going to tell you a story based on rank speculation, rumors, and a couple of well-placed leaks. We're talking about the Facebook phone, which has tech writers hyperventilating in anticipation. Word is that Facebook will unveil the phone tomorrow at its headquarters in Menlo Park. But why does a social network need its own phone? Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
One reason the Facebook phone rumors seem believable is because Facebook wants to be your one-stop shop for everything, and the phone is the obvious way to do that. Scott Steinberg is an analyst at TechSavvy.
What we're rapidly seeing is with companies, they're not simply looking to help you out with specific functions from time to time.
By one estimate, 70% of Facebook's 1 billion users are logging onto the social network with their mobile devices. Charles Govan is an analyst at Forrester Research.
More people are interacting with Facebook via their phone or tablet. That's where most of the pictures and video that are being uploaded, that's where much of the communication happens.
And that's just the basic Facebook app. You know, it looks like the one on your computer. But Facebook has other apps that have fueled speculation that it's going to bundle them all into a phone. Rakesh Agarwal is a consultant at Redesign Mobile. He says the social media giant is gaining ground with its Facebook Messenger app. It allows you to send instant messages over Wi-Fi and avoid racking up charges on your cell phone bill.
And that's increasingly becoming a threat to SMS, where people are just using Facebook Messenger instead of paying their carriers $20 a month.
And of course, we can't forget Instagram, the hugely popular photo sharing app that Facebook acquired last year. But Agarwal says that if Facebook rumors are true, the company might be getting into the business for the wrong reasons.
A lot of companies build products because they feel the need to be in a certain space. And it's possible that the Facebook phone ends up being the same thing, that they feel the need to be there, but the consumers don't feel a need to buy it.
We'll find out tomorrow. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Well, you won't have to wait for this news. Jay-Z, the new Jerry Maguire. The hip-hop star is now a sports agent, nabbing New York Yankee second baseman Robinson Cano. Cano fired one of sport's most aggressive agents to become Jay-Z's first client. The rapper is partnering with the powerhouse talent agency CAA to start a sports management company called Roc Nation Sports. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on what that could mean for Jay-Z and for baseball.
There's a short but rather checkered history of rappers as sports agents. The contract Master P got for NFL player Ricky Williams is often cited as among the worst in modern sports. But Jay-Z has shown a talent for smart partnerships and deal-making. He has a small but influential stake in the Brooklyn Nets basketball team. Andrew Zimbalist is a Smith College sports economist.
It's a very lucrative business to represent players. Grabbing a superstar like Robinson Cano is a great first step and potentially a very positive move for Jay-Z.
That could mean top sports agents have to raise their game as Jay-Z and his partners stalk their clients. And it could be positive for the sport itself. Jay-Z taking an interest in baseball could help with an issue that has recently frustrated the game.
There is a significant problem facing Major League Baseball in terms of the diversity of their audience.
Temple University sports economist Michael Leeds is talking about how African-American baseball fans and players have dwindled in recent years. Now, one of the most famous African-Americans on earth is in the baseball business. He might drive new ticket sales and stronger TV ratings. Kenneth Shropshire is a sports business professor at University of Pennsylvania.
Any positive impact would be appreciated by the game, and it's going to be interesting to see if this plays a role.
He and others are quick to say that it'll take much more than one rapper's involvement to fix baseball's audience problem. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Some discouraging numbers on jobs today. According to the ADP National Employment Report, last month U.S. companies hired at their slowest pace in 5 months. The economy is slowly making its way back to health, but there are still millions of Americans searching for a job. A new study out today looks at how race and income affect our ability to weather sudden unemployment. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark reports.
Billy Lowe is a 36-year-old man from Philadelphia who lost his job last summer. I am a 36-year-old woman from L.A. who lost my job a few years before that. There are plenty of similarities and differences between us, but for the purpose of this story, here are the main ones. We both have college degrees and consider ourselves middle class, but Billy is black and I am white. After 10 months, Billy is still unemployed.
I basically lost my house. I lost my car. I mean, everything just basically fell apart.
After I lost my job, I was freaked out, but I had lots of resources to draw upon, and I luckily got another job almost immediately. The differences between Billy's and my situation are very common, according to that study by the Pew Economic Mobility Project. It found that the ability to weather unemployment differs dramatically based on race because of historic obstacles to building assets faced by black families. That's according to researcher Aaron Currier.
White families were more likely to hold retirement savings accounts, more likely to inherit money or receive large gifts from relatives, which are often some of the first resources that families draw upon when faced with financial hardship.
So back to Billy and me. I did have a retirement savings account. I knew I could ask my mom to help with rent, and I didn't have to worry about car payments because she'd given me her old car. As for Billy, he had no retirement savings, and though his parents wanted to help,
it was basically, this is all I got. I can hand you $50 here, $50 there. But it was not enough to where they can pay my rent for 2 months or pay my car note for 2 months to try to buy some time to get another job.
And that has ripple effects, says Janet Boguslaw at Brandeis University. She interviewed dozens of black families for the study. She said in many cases,
they've depleted all of their wealth and they may be in debt. They can't start the recovery in the same way that people who have some other kind of a personal safety net would have.
Boguslaw hopes policymakers will create more incentives, maybe through the tax code, to encourage savings so we all have more assets to fall back on. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up,
One of the biggest failures of the current system is also the most obvious, which is that the IRS fails to collect a huge portion of the taxes that are levied.
Yeah, like $450 billion huge. Freakonomics straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 111 points, that's 0.75%, to end at 14,550. The NASDAQ unloaded 36 points, 1.1%, to wrap at 3218. The S&P 500 ticked down 16 points, 1%, to close at 1553. Citigroup gave back 3.75%. Morgan Stanley and Bank of America both fell 2.75%. Monsanto grew 0.8% based on strong income figures last quarter. NBC announced today that Jay Leno will step down as host of The Tonight Show next spring, ushering in the Jimmy Fallon era. Comcast, which owns NBC, was down 1.1% today. Japan's Nikkei rose 3%. Bond prices climbed. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.81%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. It's the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. First Lady Michelle Obama gets some help from school kids to plant the White House kitchen garden. And do you want to see the first U.S. 1040 tax form? It's on display this month at the National Archives Building in Washington. Why? We're marking the centennial of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, the one that authorized income tax. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. So, I went to the doctor the other day, and she started looking through my medical records to find some test results. She searched through a bunch of papers stuffed into manila folders, then she took notes with a ballpoint pen and wrote a prescription in handwriting I couldn't read. And that low-tech scene happened in Los Angeles. The feds have actually set aside $20 billion to help doctors ditch the paper records and go electronic. And while some big city doctors may be behind the electronic curve, many rural physicians are really struggling to make that transition. Christopher Husted of KBIA reports.
At the Fayette Medical Clinic in rural Missouri, Shauna Young brings her one-year-old daughter Caroline in for a checkup.
She is at the 35th percentile for her weight.
Dr. Kevin Fraser pulls up a graph of Caroline's weight on the computer in the exam room.
She's kind of been along this curve, and then...
Did she lose?
Looks like she's leveled off in the last month or so.
Because Caroline's electronic health record shows her weight has dipped, Fraser talks to Shauna about Caroline's eating habits. Healthcare providers generally have accepted electronic records as an efficient tool. It can cut costs and time. Fraser says he can use the computer to help diagnose conditions, bill patients, and show them changes in their weight or glucose levels.
It just kind of, I think, gives us more information that the patient can also see in real time.
The federal government has set a deadline. If healthcare providers don't implement an electronic health record system by 2015, they'll get dinged with Medicare penalties. The problem for many rural health clinics is they don't have the money to make the transition. Brock Slabach is Senior Vice President of the National Rural Health Association. He says there are big upfront costs for licensing the software and purchasing the computer equipment.
It could be $30,000, $40,000 per physician possibly in terms of getting one of these set up in the clinic. Possibly more, depending upon the complexities that might be present within that particular facility.
Those complexities often include adding a broadband connection, training staff to use the system, and convincing patients they won't lose their personal relationship with their doctor. Across Fayette's town square is Family Health Incorporated. Here, behind the receptionist, you'll find about a dozen metal bookshelves packed with yellow file folders. Dr. Hope Tinker still uses a paper system.
My financial resources as an independent physician are limited. If you're in a big group and you're a primary care physician, you reap the financial benefits of having access to their technology.
That's changing this month when Tinker's practice becomes part of a county hospital system, something she says was necessary to survive and remain in Fayette. The larger organization will foot the bill to update her practice with electronic records and a T1 connection line to hook into the hospital's network. Now, there is federal incentive money available to help healthcare providers go electronic. Many of the big healthcare groups are using it. But that money only comes as a reimbursement after physicians have installed the system. And in 2015, those funds disappear right when the Medicare penalties kick in. That'll affect doctors like John Ward of Boonville, Missouri.
For every year that I don't participate in electronic medical records, they dock me a small percent. And it will get bigger as the years go by, to the point where it would be prohibitive to see Medicare patients.
Ward, who is past retirement age, says he is opting out of the electronic world. It's partly the price, but also he wants to maintain FaceTime with his patients.
I fully recognize that I'm a dinosaur, and that in time, I and people who think like I do will die out, and electronic medical records are here to stay, and that's the way it's going to be, and we just have to get used to it.
Ward says if he were younger, he would take a harder look at making the financial leap for an electronic system. In Fayette, Missouri, I'm Christopher Husted for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. Every couple weeks, we talk to Stephen Dubner. He's co-author of the books and blog about the hidden side of everything. Stephen, it's good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, Sarah. Thanks for having me. It is April, which is every taxpayer's favorite month, of course.
Oh, yeah.
I thought today what we should do is take a look at the tax code we're stuck with for now and see if there are some improvements, however slight, that we should be thinking about.
Okay, so what kind of things are we talking about here?
Well, one of the biggest failures of the current system is also the most obvious, which is that the IRS fails to collect a huge portion of the taxes that are levied, that are legitimately owed. So about 17% of the total tax bill, which is more than $450 billion a year.
Whoa, what? Say that again. 17%?
Yeah.
That's pretty astounding.
It's a big number. It's called the tax gap. It's about $450 billion a year. The biggest contributor to this gap by far is very simple cash. It's all the cash that people earn and simply don't report to the IRS. Austin Goolsbee was the top White House economist under President Obama. We asked him why the government doesn't go after all that easy money.
Most of the non-collected money, for example, could be tracked and hunted down if you required small businesses to really report everything about their activity. But nobody wants to do that because that'd be so onerous and such a pain in the rear for small business owners that as a policy decision, they don't want to do it.
So in other words, Stephen, politically, it's too dangerous. It'd be like the Small Business Harassment Act, if they went after small businesses really hard.
Exactly. Even though these people are supposed to be paying taxes on that money, and even though, interestingly, the rest of us who don't pocket a lot of unreported cash, you know, we're subsidizing them. That's not to say that there aren't ways to nudge people to pay their taxes without hunting and tracking them down, as Austin Goolsbee says. One of my favorite examples of this comes from a small unit in the British government called the Behavioral Insights Team. And what they do is experiment with all kinds of cheap and simple nudges. For instance, sending out letters that appeal to the herd mentality in all of us. Here is the unit's director, David Halpern.
So what we do is we simply tell people something which is true, which is 9 out of 10 people in Britain pay their tax on time. And by putting that single bit of information into the top of a letter, it makes people much more likely themselves to pay the tax on time.
So it's pure pressure.
It's exactly right. We like to run with the herd. They also tried another super simple trick, which was just handwriting a message on the outside of the tax envelope. This message would just say simply that the contents are important, but it's written in hand.
And of course, people are like, oh my God, but how can that possibly be practical? Well, we've now just got the results in. It turns out that for every pound or every dollar that you spend on getting, you know, someone to write on the envelope, you get $2,000 return. The $1,000 to $2,000 return. So it's a nice, simple illustration of these small things and how consequential they are.
So it sounds like peer pressure and the personal touch. Those aren't bad ideas, really.
They're great ideas. They're small. They're on the margin. They also have the collective result of trying to make tax paying a little bit more, I don't know if fun is the right word, but, you know, the way the tax system is currently set up, we see paying taxes as pure downside, right? Not only does it cost us money, but it's on top of that. It's complicated. It gives us angst. And maybe worst of all, any given person has practically no say in how your hard-earned tax dollars are actually going to be spent, right? So Dan Ariely, who's a behavioral psychologist at Duke, he has a nice idea. It's to let taxpayers direct a small portion of their tax money to the parts of the government that they most care about.
So I'm not sure what's the right percent, 5%, 10%, but what if we got people to have a say about where some of the taxes go? All of a sudden, you're not looking at it as you against the government. You would have to look carefully at all that the government is doing for us, building libraries and roads and education and military, so on and so forth, and say, what do I care about?
I don't know about that. I mean, what do you think? It would be fascinating to see how many people would really want to say, gee, I want to put more money into defense or Medicare, you know?
A lot of military families out there who really feel like the military gets the short shrift. That's the thing. But you're right. The first thing you said, I absolutely agree with. We don't really know because we've never really asked and we've never really given the opportunity for people to say.
So, Stephen, what about you? Where would you put your 5 or 10%?
I think that's pretty obvious, Sarah, don't you think? I'd send it to a slush fund for people who make radio about economics.
Oh, okay. Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics correspondent. He puts out a podcast, too. You can get that on iTunes and hear more at Freakonomics.com. Stephen, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace is co-produced by WNYC and is supported by Reputation.com, helping professionals and businesses look their best when people search for them online. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally today, a tale of two pay cuts, one voluntary, the other not. President Obama has decided to give back 5% of his $400,000 salary. The White House says he's returning the money in light of all the federal workers furloughed by the sequester, or rather those automatic spending cuts. That's a sacrifice of about $20,000 a year. The CEO of struggling JCPenney, on the other hand, got a 97% cut in compensation, and that was not voluntary. That brought Ron Johnson down to about $1.9 million a year. I think both gentlemen will survive. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Sarah Gardner, back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.